Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service, with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Nick Miles, and in the early hours of Thursday, the 21st of May, these are our main stories. The government of Brazil has authorised the use of controversial anti-malaria drugs to fight COVID-19, 2 days after President Trump said he was also taking them. Two men accused of helping the former Nissan executive, Carlos Ghosn, to escape from Japan have been arrested in the United States. And France says it's working with European allies on a plan to stop Israel annexing parts of the occupied West Bank. Also in this podcast,
what the astronomers have found here is in a dense spiral of dust and gas surrounding a young star called AB Aurigae.
A swirl of dust in deep space, giving birth to a new planet. Brazil's health ministry has issued new guidelines for the use of two anti-malarial drugs to fight COVID-19, though there's no conclusive evidence that they work. The guidelines authorise the use of chloroquine and hydroxychloroquine at the first onset of symptoms. Brazil's President Jair Bolsonaro has promoted the use of the anti-malarial drugs after President Trump said he was taking hydroxychloroquine. But on Wednesday, addressing a news conference in Geneva, the head of the WHO's Health Emergencies Programme, Dr. Michael Ryan, said that the drugs had potentially dangerous side effects and there was no evidence they worked against the coronavirus.
At this stage, hydroxychloroquine, norchloroquine have been as yet found to be effective in the treatment of COVID-19 or in the prophylaxis against coming down with the disease. In fact, the opposite in that warnings have been issued by many authorities regarding the potential side effects of the drug.
So why has Brazil's health ministry just recommended using them? I heard more from our correspondent in Sao Paulo, Katie Watson.
This was actually announced on a Facebook Live on Tuesday evening. Jair Bolsonaro said that his interim health minister would be signing in new guidelines. As you said, it's to be able to use the anti-malarial drugs from the onset of symptoms, very minor symptoms. At the moment, it's just for critical patients. In order to do that, patients will have to sign a waiver which acknowledges the potential side effects. That includes heart, liver problems, retina damage. That's on the waiver if you do decide to take the drugs. But, I mean, this has been a long time coming for Jair Bolsonaro. Jair Bolsonaro has been promoting the use of the anti-malarial drugs from the very start. And, in fact, it also caused problems. It's why we saw the exit of his health minister just last week. There's only an interim at the moment because the health minister didn't see eye to eye with the president on the drugs.
So this comes as Brazil recorded for the first time more than 1,000 deaths from coronavirus in the last 24 hours, over 1,100 of them. Is there the government wouldn't admit to this, I'm sure, but is there a sense that people think there's a desperation from the government now?
I don't sense the desperation within the government. It's certainly in the federal government. It feels like Jair Bolsonaro is cracking on as normal. And in fact, the fact that they're no longer Nelson Teich is in the seat in the health ministry and instead Eduardo Pazuello, who's the interim, it's almost like he is able to tell him what to do and to tell him how he wants to be able to handle this crisis. And so it's just a kind of green light, if you like, for Jair Bolsonaro. Meanwhile, I think there's definitely a sense of concern here in Brazil with the numbers going up and up. And there's no sign of knowing when the curve will be flattened or where indeed Brazil is on the curve, because testing's so limited and there's a real concern of underreporting of the actual true figures in the country.
Katie Watson in Brazil. The World Health Organization says 106,000 new coronavirus cases have been reported in the last 24 hours. That's the most in a single day since the outbreak began. Speaking in Geneva, its head, Dr. Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus, said the vast majority were in just four countries.
We still have a long way to go in this pandemic. We're very concerned about the rising numbers of cases in low- and middle-income countries. And WHO is supporting member states to ensure supply chains remain open and medical supplies reach health workers and patients.
Well, it's against this background that all across Europe, different countries whose economies depend on tourism are in a real race to prove that they're safe to reopen before the summer season. Greece has announced plans to reopen its holiday resorts from the middle of next month, as has Cyprus for some visitors, but tourists might have to disinfect their luggage when they arrive. Portugal is going to allow some international visitors from the 6th of June. And on Wednesday, EU tourism ministers met again with the message that they do whatever it takes for the quick and full recovery of European tourism. The BBC's Gavin Lee in Brussels has more on that.
I think the takeaway is there's no master plan in place. Different countries will have different strategies when it comes to, say, hotel rules or beach etiquette. We know in Santorini, for example, in the past few days, they've organised for plexiglass screens on sun loungers 4 metres apart to distance people on the beaches. In Portugal, Croatia, Spain, they're looking at the same thing. You've also got different rules for hotels, and what you and I will get is an interactive guide which is being worked on now at EU level. So we can look at any country and decide, shall we go there on holiday? What is the government doing? What are the hotels doing as well? So that should be developed in the next few weeks. Then it comes to flights. How will we fly? Will we be tested? There was a disagreement today. Some ministers say, in particularly hard-hit countries from COVID-19, there should be pre-flight testing and set up safe corridors so that everybody on those flights have been tested and perhaps test them again for COVID-19 when they get to their arrival destination, whereas other ministers from countries less affected were far more relaxed. One saying that he's happy for them to literally walk onto the street after landing because social distancing measures are in place. My takeaway from this is there's no big joint thinking at the moment, but there is momentum. And by this time next month, we'll have at least 8 countries who believe they'll be opening up their countries again to tourism.
Now to Italy, where quarantine restrictions are being dropped from next month to allow visitors back there. Our correspondent Mark Lowen has been to Lake Como, one of Italy's most popular destinations.
The tourist ferry has set off across the stunning waters of Lake Como. This is just the most exquisite scene. I'm surrounded by lush, dramatic mountains, majestic spires and villas on the lake, including that of George Clooney. But at the moment, there are no tourists. Coronavirus has cleared them away, but Italy is hoping to welcome them back as early as the 3rd of June.
Italy was the first in the world to impose a national lockdown, but now it's unlocking quickly. From next week, visitors from Europe will be welcomed in, the quarantine on entry dropped. The hotelier Luca Leoni says when he reopens, he and others will extend their season through until January, hoping confidence and the key British market returns.
British tourists are the first they arrive on Lake Como at the end of the 18th century. So we are now ready to welcome them again. It's not a question of working with them, but it's to share our feeling with them, our soul, our heart with them, and we want them to be back so as soon as possible.
For now, Lake Como glitters in its tranquility. But with an expected recession of 10%, Italy needs to restart. Yet with it comes the fear of infections rising again as tourists arrive. It's a risk, but one that Il Bel Paese, the beautiful country, is ready to take.
Mark Lowen on Italy's Lake Como. But the situation is very different in Spain. The Spanish Parliament has just voted to extend the state of emergency declared in March for another 2 weeks beyond this weekend. The Prime Minister, Pedro Sanchez, said no one had the right to waste what had been achieved so far. Guy Hedgeco reports from Madrid.
This is the fifth extension to the state of emergency that Socialist Prime Minister Pedro Sanchez has requested of Congress since March. It was approved by a narrow margin after a debate in which the right-wing opposition fiercely attacked Mr. Sanchez's handling of the coronavirus crisis. This month, the country has begun a three-phase lifting of its strict lockdown, varying from province to province. In most of the country, bars and restaurants have been partially opened and other measures have been lifted. But Madrid and Barcelona remain under tighter restrictions.
Guy Hedgeco in Spain. Dramatic pictures have been coming out of Bangladesh and eastern India as Cyclone Amphan made landfall. Palm trees being thrashed by ferocious winds, roofs being lifted off buildings, telephone lines and electricity poles being brought down. Along the coast, huge waves, some described as more than 5 metres high, were seen crashing onto land as the rain lashed down. Satya Narayan Pradhan is Director General of the Indian National Disaster Response Force.
It will be the poor who will be affected here. These are poor districts inhabited by poor people with thatched huts and tin roofs and asbestos roofs. And we could have a pretty destructive picture or a trail of destruction, which would take some time to then get together.
As we record this podcast, at least 15 people are reported to have died. Millions of others have been evacuated, a task made extra difficult for authorities due to COVID-19 and social distancing measures. Sabir Mustafa of BBC Bengali told me more.
It seems the biggest damage, the most widespread damage, was done in West Bengal in India. And the chief minister of West Bengal said at least 10 people have died. And he mentioned two large districts near Kolkata as having been destroyed. I mean, I don't know what she means by whole districts being destroyed, but it seems that those districts, which are kind of coastal and some inland, they've faced quite a bit of devastation from the cyclone. So the main force of the cyclone went through West Bengal and partially through southwestern Bangladesh. And the southwestern part of Bangladesh faced something like up to 100 kilometers wind speed of the cyclone, which is a lot, but not as much as was feared even 2 days ago. But it has still caused a lot of tidal waves because of the full moon, which is quite worrying because a lot of people can die if they were not evacuated from those areas. And we know in Bangladesh, you know, more than 2 million people were evacuated along the coast.
We were hearing earlier about the fact that it is a double disaster, this cyclone hitting at the same time as this part of the world, as the rest of the world, is trying to deal with the COVID-19 pandemic. How likely is it that there's going to be an ability to socially distance in a lot of these shelters?
Well, I think this has been the biggest challenge the government faced, you know, how to ensure that. Now, what the government is saying is that they requisitioned a lot of schools, which are closed anyway, and turned them into cyclone shelters just to create more space. They used to have 5,000 permanent shelters in that area. Now they're saying that they're using something like 15,000 buildings to house evacuees. Even then, social distancing is virtually impossible because they're all being put in one single room. So how can you separate people in one single room? And people are having to sit there or lie there. And even though the government and the government agencies and the relief agencies and the Red Crescent, they're saying we're using, giving them hand sanitizers, etc. But a lot of people we've talked to over telephone, they've said or seen mobile videos are saying that we were not giving any masks. Only people who had masks themselves, brought their own masks from their home, had masks. The government or any relief agency or NGOs had actually dished out masks. So, this is a very, very big challenge.
That was Sabir Mustafa. Well, let's go to the United States now, because floodwaters there have continued to rise in the state of Michigan, where two dams were breached on Tuesday after record rainfall. Officials say water levels in the city of Midland could reach an historic high. Thousands of people have also been evacuating areas along the Tittabawassee River. The city manager, Brad Kay, has urged residents not to ignore the flood threat and to use local refuges.
We do have shelters that are open and available to them with beds that are available and will be available for as long as they need them. The message is take it seriously. This is an important flood. It's a serious flood. It damages property. It will damage property and it seriously risks lives.
Images taken from helicopters in the area show vast stretches of land underwater, bridges washed away and homes and buildings flooded. Let's stay in the US now, because many families across America have been struggling with remote learning during the coronavirus outbreak. With so many schools closed, the classroom has gone online. And for the least well-off children, that often means struggling to get Wi-Fi or learning on a telephone, not a laptop. New York City has 1.1 million public school children. Among them are the poorest and most disadvantaged in the nation. Laura Trevelyan reports now on how the neediest kids are dealing with the challenges of the virtual classroom.
Little mermaid? I found it.
Yeah, that's Ariel.
I want to be Ariel.
Oh, I wish.
Eighth grader Niobe Rodriguez is keeping her younger siblings busy and thinking about her schoolwork. Since the end of March, the girls have been confined to their cramped apartment in the Bronx, trying to learn remotely while sharing a laptop.
Do you miss school?
Yes, very much.
What do you miss the most?
I miss my friends and all the teachers, because I usually, I'm very close to the teachers. We're really good friends, student to teacher. And it seems easier to learn in a classroom than having to do by remote.
Stand clear of the closing doors, please.
Growing up in the Bronx was challenging for Niobe and her sisters even before the pandemic. But now, the gap between rich and poor students has got even wider.
New York is the epicenter of the global coronavirus outbreak, and the Bronx has been hit the hardest. This area was already the poorest in America. Now it has the city's highest death toll and mass unemployment. Remote learning for kids is just another hardship on top of all the others they already faced.
Good morning, 853. How are we all doing?
Jonki Patel teaches 8th graders in the Bronx, and now she's doing it from her apartment. She's part of the Teach for America organisation, which tries to confront the inequalities in education. Right now, Jonki is trying to provide answers for her students.
Their biggest question is, when will it end? And unfortunately, we don't have the answer to that.
How about the kids? How are they reacting to the remote learning?
I am really inspired by the strength and resilience my kids have shown. It's a very uncertain time for all of us, and there are so many answers that we don't have, but they've really stepped up to the challenge of virtual learning. They're helping one another get through it. They're supporting their community. They're asking questions when they're unsure, and they're taking ownership over their new way of learning.
Is it sustainable for the long term? No, I don't think so. And the best
Councilman Joe Borelli, a Republican who's on the Education Committee, is hopeful that New York City schools can reopen in September. He says the longer this goes on, the worse it is for the disadvantaged students.
I'm a parent, so I see within my own child how some progress he's made in reading and language as a young four-year-old. Is sort of going by the wayside now as he struggles to deal with the computer learning. So I can only imagine how much more this is a problem for students who really don't have the type of environment at home and the technology to concentrate and to be focused on their work.
Back in the Bronx, Niobe is working away on her battered laptop, determined to keep up her grades as she heads towards high school. Like so many students, her graduation from 8th grade this summer will be remote.
I'm pretty sad about it because I'm the one in the family that really wanted to graduate so much, because ever since my 5th grade graduation, it's been my dream to graduate from 8th grade and go into high school.
What were you most looking forward to about the real graduation?
Probably just seeing my principal give a speech to all the 8th graders telling us how to move on in the world and how we can achieve our dreams.
Far beneath the ocean waves, in the land of the merpeople, lives a lovely young mermaid named Ariel.
Niobe wants to make the world she lives in more just, and she hopes to be a lawyer. The pandemic is exposing the inequalities in American society, but Niobe is resilient and she's dreaming big.
She and Flounder would swim in and out of second ships.
Laura Trevelyan reporting there. Now, news of another podcast from the BBC World Service.
Summer 1940. Adolf Hitler was poised to invade Britain. German bombers struck British factories, airfields, towns and cities. Stopping the onslaught took a very special plane. The best fighter plane in the world. The Spitfire. Before a plane could save a country, the people had to build it.
The enemy is making preparations for the invasion of Britain. How are we going to meet and overcome this danger?
The plane would be assembled in the communities it was designed to protect. Towns and villages were new Spitfire factories. The planes built by a fresh generation of young men and women. This is the story of the people who built the plane that won the war. Spitfire, the people's plane. A brand new podcast from the BBC World Service. Just search for Spitfire, the people's plane, wherever you get your podcasts.
Two men wanted on suspicion of helping the former Nissan boss, Carlos Ghosn, escape from Japan, have been arrested in the United States. Mr. Ghosn fled whilst he was on bail, awaiting trial after being charged with underreporting his income and misusing company funds. Japan has issued arrest warrants for the men. Barbara Pletasha reports.
Court papers tell the tale of an escape plot facilitated by a former U.S. Special Forces soldier, Michael Taylor, and his son Peter. They say the elder Mr. Taylor and a Lebanese accomplice flew into Japan in December with two large black boxes. They claim to be musicians carrying audio equipment, but instead are alleged to have helped Carlos Ghosn hide in one of the boxes, which they then loaded onto a private jet. 2 days later, Mr. Ghosn showed up in Lebanon.
Barbara Pletasha. France says it's working with its European partners on a plan to prevent Israel annexing parts of the occupied West Bank. The French Foreign Minister, Jean-Yves Le Drian, said the discussions included the possibility of reprisal action if annexation went ahead. He said the move by Israel would put peace at risk.
This would be extremely damaging and for us would constitute a serious violation of all the justifications of an occupation of this or that territory by force, which is not acceptable for us on one hand, and on the other hand, it puts into question the two-state solution and the search for a sustainable peace in an irreversible manner.
Israel has indicated that it may start the process of extending its sovereignty to areas of the West Bank in the weeks to come. The idea is bitterly opposed by the Palestinians, who want the territory for a state of their own. The United States has imposed sanctions on Iran's interior minister and other senior security officials, accusing them of human rights abuses that led to the deaths of many people. More from our Middle East analyst, Alan Johnston.
The sanctions are spelt out in a US Treasury statement which focused heavily on events in Iran last November. Sharp petrol price rises led to widespread anti-government protests. The Treasury statement said that the Interior Minister, Abdulreza Rahmani Fazli, had ordered the security forces to use deadly force. Rights activists say hundreds of demonstrators died. Iranian state media said the security forces had killed what it described as thugs and rioters.
Alan Johnston. Meanwhile, the British-Iranian woman Nazanin Zaghari Ratcliffe, who's serving a five-year jail sentence in Iran, has had her temporary release from prison extended for a third time. She was freed initially in March as coronavirus swept through Iranian jails, and had been due to return, but now she's been told she can remain at her parents' home until a decision's made on whether to grant her clemency. Venezuela has launched legal proceedings against the Bank of England to try to force it to release $1 billion worth of Venezuelan gold. The bullion is retained under sanctions by British and US authorities, which don't recognise the government of President Nicolas Maduro as legitimate. But the Venezuelan government's lawyers say the gold is needed to fight the country's coronavirus pandemic. These Venezuelans explain just how tough life is at the moment.
You can queue for the whole day, and then they still don't have any fuel. It causes a lot of frustration. We are living on top of a sea of oil. I could never imagine that at 71 years old, I was going to be spending the whole night queuing to get fuel.
Right now, I haven't had proper food for a week. We get food for the day. We can buy some flour and cheese, and that is what we eat today. Every day, what I can do is thank God for what we can bring to the mouth.
Susanna Streeter spoke to Guillermo Olmo, the BBC's correspondent in Venezuela. He told her just how badly the economy has deteriorated and how this row over gold reserves is being viewed.
This is a country that has been suffering from a long economic crisis. The Venezuelan GDP has lost 50% since Nicolas Maduro gained the presidency in 2013. Now, with the situation of the coronavirus has created, the economic impact has been terrible. So that's why probably the government is trying to get any kind of cash. It's trying to get ready to cope with the situation. And that's a situation that might be getting even worse in the next few days because, well, the number of cases reported by the Venezuelan authorities, the number of positive cases of coronavirus reported over the last 3 days have been the highest since they started recorded. So it seems that perhaps Nicolas Maduro's government is fearing that the situation could deteriorate quickly, and it's trying to regain all the assets it has scattered all around the world and locked by the effect of international sanctions, the American sanctions.
Do the Venezuelan people feel as though money has been squandered by the Venezuelan government? And do you think they would support the United Nations administering this money?
Well, I would say that Venezuelans would thank and would support any kind of help coming into the country now because the situation here is dire. It's true that, well, not most of the public seems to be quite sure about the ability of the government to manage these funds or any funds. This is a government that is widely seen as corrupt, is widely seen as unfair to its own people. So I guess that many people here would be happy if the UN and other international agencies stepped in and helped fight the pandemic.
Guillermo Olmo in Venezuela. And the Bank of England has told the BBC that it does not comment on its relationships with individual customers. Astronomers believe that they may have found the first direct evidence of a new planet being born. It suggests a world in the process of forming. Terry Egan reports.
What the astronomers have found here is in a dense spiral of dust and gas surrounding a young star called AB Aurigae. It's about 520 light-years from Earth, and inside it is what they're calling a twist, a very bright yellow region near the centre of the spiral. That, they think, reveals a baby planet, and the astronomers, using the European Southern Observatory's Very Large Telescope in Chile, were able to take a snap. Emmanuel Di Falco is one of those who helped take it.
This is the first time that we detect this twist. We already knew many exoplanets, but older exoplanets. We have had, 2 years ago, the first detection of a very young planet in another system, but this is the very first time that we do see the process, the physical process that brings matter together to form a young planet. And this is probably the youngest protoplanets, the youngest forming protoplanets that we are seeing with these images.
The twist lies at about the same distance from its star as Neptune is from our Sun, and it suggests a new world in the process of coming into existence. Until now, astronomers had been unable to take such clear images of young spirals to see this twist, and yet they need to observe such systems to really capture the moment when planets come into being and to understand their formation.
Terry Egan reporting there. And that's all from us for now, but there's going to be an updated version of the Global News podcast later on. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics we've covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Nick Miles, and until next time, goodbye.